This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm here today at the University College London with Professor Raman Prinja. Hi.
Hi, so pleased to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. So, Professor Prinja, what do you work on?
My research is mainly concerned with the most massive stars in our galaxy, so we're interested in studying these stars and their outflows and the stellar winds from the stars, and we're interested to understand how they evolve. So these are the most massive objects in the galaxy.
How massive?
Well, typically a massive star, we would say, is maybe has birth mass when it's born of maybe a mass of 10, 20, 50 times the mass of the Sun. They would have luminous output that's millions of times the luminous output of the Sun. And they have prolific stellar winds compared to the solar wind, which is actually quite feeble compared to these. So that this kind of constitutes massive stellar objects of this kind, massive stars.
And what does produce those winds? Where do they come from?
These winds are essentially, they're driven by radiation pressure. The intensities, if you like, the temperatures of the stars are very, very high. There's an intense radiation field in these stars. And the radiation pressure literally drives the outflow from away from the stars as mass loss. So a transfer of momentum from radiation to the gas, and that's the driving mechanism for pushing these stellar winds at great speeds, thousands of kilometers per second, away from the stars. And it's actually lost, the material is lost. I mean, the Sun loses something like 10 to the minus 14 solar masses per year, 10 to the minus 14 of its own mass per year. Well, these massive stars, they lose something like 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year, so huge increase in mass loss, which can actually alter their evolution.
Okay, so this mass just goes in medium around? What happens to it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's very significant because the other reason these massive stars are very interesting is because these are the stars that, by nuclear fusion processing, make the heavy elements. So all that carbon and nitrogen and oxygen is made inside massive stars. And it's mixed up and brought up to the surfaces as the star evolves. So this is the material that is pushed out into interstellar medium. So all that chemically enriched material, the way the galaxy is actually being chemically enriched is because of these outputs from massive stars. And this material is lost in stellar winds or bigger eruptions like supernovae, of course, ultimately, and put back into the interstellar medium to make the next generation of stars and planets, effectively, and life.
That's really cool. And is there any other reason to study those winds? Does it have an impact on the star itself or anything else?
Well, it alters the evolution of the star. So we're interested in understanding the birth, life, and death of stars. So the first challenge is, how do you actually make the most massive stars? How do you actually form stars that are 100 times as massive as the Sun, for example? So that's an interesting challenge in itself. And you know, it's a lot of debate, and it's not yet resolved, at how to make the most massive stars. And when the universe first started out after the Big Bang, the first stars to form were thought to be very, very massive stars as well. So you could see an analog here. If we could understand them in the local universe, we might be able to understand the very first stars that were made, because they are indeed very, very massive. So we're interested in the birth of the stars. We're interested in the evolution. These stars evolve much faster than the Sun, for example. The Sun in its current stable phase, it's what we call its hydrogen burning phase, will last about 10 to the 10 years in total. We're about halfway through that for the case of the Sun. We're about 5 billion years old. And these stars will, this same phase, will only last a few million years. These stars are rapidly evolving stars. So we're interested in understanding how they evolve. And ultimately, these are the stars that detonate as supernovae explosions. So it becomes important to understand that process into the final demise of the object that will then become a neutron star or a black hole. So there's a whole range, and it's all related to the entire stellar evolution process. And we're very, very interested to explore all of that.
In terms of, like, how frequent is it to see massive stars? Like, is there a large population of massive stars, or are they more like rare objects?
They're actually relatively very rare objects. I mean, in our local environment, it's really solar type stars. In our galaxy, it's dominated by the sort of low mass stars. So, in comparison, massive stars are actually very rare. But their contribution is significant because they are putting out so much material and so much chemically processed material. So although they are very low in population in our galaxy, comparatively, their output is tremendous, and therefore it can have a significant effect. Also in just sculpting the shape of the environment around themselves through their stellar winds and radiation.
And you observe those winds and those stars in just in the optical, or is it multiple wavelengths?
This is a truly multi-wavelength investigation, actually. This is truly that, because we study them in the ultraviolet, in the far ultraviolet, using space-borne facilities like Hubble Space Telescope or the FUSE ultraviolet satellite. So we can study them in the ultraviolet, and they have very key, prolific diagnostics for us to explore. And then we're equally able to study them with the optical, for example, the Balmer lines.
What's the Balmer line?
This is a key transition. For example, hydrogen alpha, which is, if you look at why a lot of these images you see in space, for example, a lot of hydrogen is emitted around about 6.5, sort of middle of the optical wave band, that sort of reddish hue that you often see. That's Balmer H alpha, for example. So we can observe them from the optical very well, and we study a lot. We observe them in the X-rays, again, using the Chandra satellite and the XMM satellites. We use that. And we're also observing them with the radio telescopes. And we have a major project with eMerlin here at UCL, which we're leading on studying these stars.
And what different characteristics do you see in different wavelengths?
We are able to almost scan the outflows, if you like. If you go to the optical, primarily, you can study what the photosphere is doing. That's the surface itself. By studying this, this is all done through spectroscopy in all these cases, in optical and UV. So the spectroscopy, by decoding the spectral line information, by decoding that information, we can understand in the optical what's going on in the surfaces of the stars and in the very inner wind, if you like, the very just as it leaves the stellar surface. We can study that in the optical very well. In the case of the ultraviolet, we get a much longer column of material that we can study, which is, if you like, integrated over the whole stellar wind. And in, for example, radio, we're studying the outer regions of this outflow. So we're able to almost use these different wave bands to scan across the entire radial region, if you like, of these stars, right from the surface out to great distances, hundreds of stellar radii away from it.
So it's like looking at the envelope of the star or the...
The entire envelope, you know, by sampling these different waveband regions. So it's like getting the full picture, right? Not just sort of studying one corner of, you know, one little part of it and not knowing what's going on in 10, 50 stellar radii out. We're able to study the whole flow in that case.
So you said at the beginning that you actually are going to have probably an eMerlin program. What would be, like, what's interesting in looking at those massive stars? Because eMerlin is it's a big interferometer. You can see a lot of details. What's the importance of looking at those stars with such a telescope?
Well, what we're interested in doing is we have a legacy program given awarded to us, and we are going to do some very deep field mapping of a substantial association of massive stars. It's called SIGOVI-2. So this region in our galaxy is one of the largest collections, if you like, of massive stars that we can pick up on, and we can conduct a deep field survey of these objects to gain essentially have an enormous amount of information on their radio properties across a very large range of massive stars, and go quite deep in there and try to understand not just how those stars formed, but also there'll be an association of younger, sort of young type stars in there, and there'll be binary stars interacting. There are two massive stars that are close to each other, and their stellar winds are colliding. So all these processes are taking place, and we can pick them all up using radio observations, using the high sensitivity of eMerlin. We can look at all these different objects in a large association like SIGOVI-2. So we can just deep field map this core of this thing and pick up hundreds of interesting objects of that kind in one go. And that'll be very, very interesting. It'll have an impact on what I've just been describing in terms of massive star evolution and winds. It'll also have an impact on understanding when massive star winds collide and you have these high energy processes taking place. What's going on in these collisions as these big supersonic outflows smash into each other? So we've got to study those. The other thing we can do is, because eMerlin offers very high astrometric precision, that is, that you can allow us to actually see, if you like, the motion. If we were to observe the association over 2-3 years, we'd be able to actually pick out the motion of these stars, actually see how the collection of stars is spreading, if you like, or evolving out as a group. And this teaches us how star formation and clusters form. And these are massive clusters, and again, very good analogs for big superclusters that we know are present in other galaxies as well. So
you just said earlier that those massive stars are pretty rare. How can you have them in such a a close group all together, that's pretty special, isn't it?
Yeah, it is very special. I think this is one of the reasons why we're interested in trying to understand why they are there in the first place. I mean, it would be rare to see large collections of massive stars like this, and this is why it's such a fantastic opportunity to understand the formation process of something, of why they would form as a huge cluster of them. So they are exceptional. We are looking to understand whether they might be triggered in some way, the formation of these stars. Is it triggered because there are other massive stars that trigger the next generation of massive stars? Is there some kind of triggering going on here? But we don't know. We just are very interested to understand. And it's an opportunity. It's a fantastic opportunity. Cygnus-B2 in our galaxy allows us a great opportunity to study a collection of massive stars like this. And that is rare.
Are those massive stars, can you study them in galaxies outside of the Milky Way, or is the study limited to the Milky Way for instrumentation reason?
No, they're very prolific. You can study them in other, I mean, you couldn't do it with eMerlin, the kinds of sensitivity that we're trying to do for the radio, but in other wave bands, and you know, it is possible to study clusters of massive stars. For example, a Large Magellanic Cloud has some prolific clusters of massive stars in them, and you can study them in other wave bands. To some extent, as you go further out, you're studying them as a collection rather than as individual objects. You're actually studying their collective influence in a galaxy. But then when you become interested in the details of them, then you have to come back to our local cases to try and decode some really interesting information that you could then reapply to more distant galaxies where they're not fully resolved.
Really cool. Well, thank you very much, Professor Prinja.
My absolute pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. And bye.
Bye.